This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, June 5th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. We are seeing the return of something similar to an institution cast aside long ago, debtors' prisons, where the inability to pay fines associated with small crimes means jail time and worse. Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, evaluates the incentives for the parties involved. We're beginning to hear about people who end up spending, not insignificant times in jail because they're unable to pay fees that they owe the government. And these people are often have been charged with crimes and are unable to pay.
Charged with crimes and sometimes with very small crimes. National Public Radio just did a series on this, which is focused attention on it, although the abuses have been getting coverage for a few years now. And the stories told by NPR will begin with something like catching a fish out of season or making an illegal left turn, things that don't sound as if they would get you very deeply entangled with the criminal justice system, but they carry a fine. And if the fine is $150, it might sound like something that even a relatively poor person could handle. And then the combination of additional penalties for not sending in a check on time or not making a court appearance with the a la carte extra expenses that and this is something that have really mushroomed in the last 30 years, things like charges for your own arrest warrant or charges for the time you spend in jail on a per diem basis for your room and board. Many of these things will turn that initial very small obligation into thousands of dollars. And so you wind up with originally petty offenses leading to people being completely buried under the snowballing legal obligations. This also happens to people who are in jail. NPR tells the story of a woman who emerged from jail, and she had had problems, I think, with drugs in her case. So she gets out of jail, but she's got a $10,000 debt hanging over her. It's kind of like student debt, except that you haven't had the education. And here she is obligated to pay the $10,000, and bankruptcy will not do it because of the way that the rules are set up on that. And what makes it such a treadmill that you can't outrun for many people is that the consequences of not making a payment can mean that you have violated your probation, so you are subject to arrest again, and you're back in the criminal system. You don't just owe money, but you are one step away from being dragged back into the criminal system.
You've written about this in some slightly different contexts, which is the attempt to privatize some government services.
Yeah. It is easy. It has been easy for some of us on the libertarian side. It's also been easy for some legislators to take and run with the idea of user fees or restitution or people should be paying for the system if they are requiring its operation. And there is certainly a germ of logic within that, and yet the germ can grow into something completely different from what it immediately appears. When the system is set up to incentivize the collection of fees, and we certainly see this with the problems of asset forfeiture, in which, again, it looks as if who could be against helping police budgets. Much of this came in the same way. The cost of incarceration was skyrocketing when the combination of the war on crime and the war on drugs led to tremendous building of new correctional institutions. The money had to come from somewhere. Legislators resisted the idea of allocating more money to such an unpopular thing. And so about 30 years ago, Michigan made itself the first state to begin charging a room and board fee, just as if you were at a motel, for the privilege of being in prison. And this has now spread to most states. And category after category, if you remember Gideon v. Rainwright, the right to have a court-appointed lawyer, well, they didn't say it was a right to a free court-appointed lawyer. So now that's part of your charge in more than 40 states. The electronic ankle monitoring or alcohol monitoring, which is sometimes a requirement of not being jailed, well, that may be $400 a month, as in one of the cases that NPR cited. And that $400 a month for, you know, affordable enough for many middle-class persons makes the difference for people who had just been scraping by and had trouble paying their rent in the first place. And on through different categories, the drug and alcohol counseling that the court may require may come with a fee. And this is dangerous enough when the fees are all going to the governmental entities, because as we know from the asset forfeiture case, they can begin to have their own incentives warped by that toward being more punitive, dragging more people in the system and not letting them out. One of the things that makes this especially dangerous is the role of private entities that are administering parts of the system. And the one that has gotten a lot of focus from journalists is private probation services, because companies will be called in to take over the probation function to make sure that people are behaving themselves and collect the fees and so forth. But these companies, as has now been shown in a series of journalistic exposés, also have reason sometimes to keep people entangled. And so where a probation officer trying to follow the ideals of the correctional system or the criminal justice system will be faced with someone coming in, well, why are you half an hour late? Well, it's because the bus broke down. Might actually turn on the radio to see whether the bus broke down. In the case of a company that gets more money every time it finds a violation, it may simply write up a violation. And the companies have been particularly criticized for so-called tolling, that is, part of the penalty for missing a payment or whatever is to have your probation extended another 6 months. Well, it becomes something that you just can't drag yourself out of. Again, the role of judgment in the system, you want, particularly for the gray areas like probation where there's a chance of someone coming back to being a fully productive, lawful citizen, you want there to be the judgment of, is the person genuinely trying to beat the system? Are there problems due to their own lack of compliance, or is it something else? And judges still have some of that discretion. Sometimes they use it better, sometimes they use it worse. But in the NPR series, there's case after case where, for example, a frequent problem is simply, do people get their mail? There'll be a notice of a court appearance. Many people who are poor have relatively disorganized lives. In the case written up, the person bounced. He was 19 years old. He bounced between his parents' house, his grandparents' house, and sometimes other people's house who would put him up. And so he said he simply wasn't there when they sent it to what had been his address before. But missing a court appearance can start you down that toboggan.
And there is sort of a philosophical issue here with respect to, if you're found guilty of XYZ, what is your actual debt? What is your debt to society, right? So normally we think of, well, if you go to jail, you are separated from society. That is your debt. It is not – it's our job to pay to keep you out of society, because we, however constructed, have decided these are the rules that we expect everyone to live by.
You know, restitution can make a lot of sense when someone has stolen someone else's property. It begins to mean something more and more abstract when you talk about fishing out of season making a left turn against the signal when no one has been injured. And when it becomes a simple cash source for the government, whether rationalized as supporting the system of justice or just for general revenue, it becomes simply an additional penalty. Now, one of the ways in which this distorts our thinking about the legal system is that the press will cover such and such a law as if it has a maximum penalty of $500, and people think, oh, well, $500, if they can't do the time, they shouldn't do the crime, or 30 days or $30 in the old movies. So people are underestimating the real onerousness of penalties, because penalties that can seem small are very large, but they are also packing into the concept of paying back to society things that people often just don't have the means to give. And if you do that, you wind up with more incarceration, and we know that's incredibly expensive. You may wind up with the public actually paying more in the long run, because when one of these cases results in sending someone behind bars again, you know we're paying.
So what do we do if we want to respect this idea that we don't want to entangle people unnecessarily in the justice system? We don't want to incentivize particularly harsh treatment of often poor people, and still understand that if you're, you know, of means, that, you know, if you get fined, you need to pay it.
It's not an easy question. If it were easy, we would have come up with better answers before now. Some of it lies in judicial discretion, and some judges complain that the laws their states have enacted make it too automatic for them to have to pile on the cost, even when they think they will never be repaid. So more judicial discretion in the direction of mercy would help. Addressing very carefully the incentives, who is getting the money, are the same people who are getting money making the rules? Should we be doing more ankle braceleting at the behest of lobbying by ankle bracelet firms? or should we somehow or other try to screen out their message and make a decision more objectively? It isn't easy, and of course some of our friends on the left will say, do away with fines or make them all proportional, so that if Bill Gates makes an illegal left turn, he has to pay $300 million. You know, that doesn't make sense either. We do know that the role of fines in the system used to be much more under control than it is now, and we should look at the ways in which things changed and ask whether it was necessary to change them that way.
Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at overlawyer.com and cato.org.